Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. Coming up in that time, we'll be hearing about how the over 45s have plenty to contribute to the new technological workplace and shouldn't feel that new technology is beyond them. We'll also be hearing about a new campaign started by the NHS and Public Health England to remind us that although we're all rightly concerned with COVID-19, other diseases such as lung cancer haven't gone away and we should be on our lookout for them. Then we'll be hearing about a campaign to save a local charity which for the past 26 years has been providing help and support in cases of domestic abuse, but which has recently and unexpectedly lost a lot of its funding. And finally, I'll be telling you about a TV programme that's helped me to cope with the recent lockdowns and which you may not have come across. It's still available, and you can catch up online on all the back episodes. In amongst all that, there'll be some music, and on this occasion, just for a change, it's all going to be classical music. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. OK, let's get going with our first item. As everybody knows, life is becoming increasingly dominated by IT, both at home and in the office. This situation is particularly difficult for some older employees, who perhaps find it difficult to keep up with the constant technical developments in a field that appears to be specifically designed for younger people. And they may feel that they have nothing much to offer. Well, this couldn't be further from the truth. As always, experience is very valuable. And contrary to the popular opinion, you can teach an old dog new tricks. In order to help with this situation, Microsoft, in conjunction with a Sussex-based employment agency called Restless, which specialises in finding jobs for older and also disabled people, have come up with an online training scheme designed not only to tell you about IT itself, but to increase your confidence with it. To find out more, I spoke to Simon Lambert, the Chief Learning Officer from Microsoft, and Stuart Lewis, who is an employment expert at Restless. Unfortunately, the Zoom circuit on which I spoke to them was not very good, so I must apologise in advance for the poor sound quality of this interview. I began by asking Simon what the factors are that deter older people from taking training in IT and applying for IT jobs.
Well, I think the tech industry has traditionally been viewed as an industry for individuals with a certain skill set and background, and taking a first step into that space can be challenging because there are tech roles in every industry and it can look daunting from outside if it's not something you've done or even considered before. But I do think it's important that career switchers recognise the huge variety of roles available in the tech industry, from marketing to web development to more technical, which are more open and available to people from all walks of life. And we anticipate and expect by 2025 up to 3 million new technology jobs being created. And these can provide opportunities for people who are considering exploring a new career at any age. And so we're trying to encourage people to really look at these opportunities in a lot more detail.
Yes, there does tend to be this attitude that computers and the like are something that young people instinctively understand and older people can't get their heads around. And I know from experience, from my own experience when I was still working, that I used to feel slightly stupid when talking to younger colleagues about what we could do with the computers, and they couldn't understand why I couldn't understand what they were telling me, because they were using a lot of technical jargon and speaking very fast.
Well, certainly there's been advances in technology, and with increasing advances like cloud computing, artificial intelligence, that, you know, all these things are transforming the world's economies and changing the labour market and reshaping how people are working. And I think, you know, giving the people the opportunity to learn or improve their skills At any age, it's not only important to improving long-term employability, but it also gives companies access to a more diverse talent pool. And there's a lot that this age group can bring to organizations.
I think we see a range of stereotypical views of age and technological savviness. I think one of the things that I'm always fascinated to point out to people is the over 45s are the first digitally native cohort of society washing through. And actually, one of the stats that came out from the research is that 6 in 10 of the people surveyed considered themselves digitally literate. So actually, we see this quite a big gap between what external perceptions are, perhaps, of someone's digital capability versus actually what the reality is. And you see this digital exclusion is something that cuts across all strata of society, men and women, and people of all ages. And actually, it's not historically like it was only targeted a certain older demographic.
And when older people actually give IT a try, they quite often find it's not as difficult as they thought it was.
Exactly right. There's two main barriers I think we see. One is that the idea of a career in the technology industry can be incredibly impenetrable. What does that mean? The type of roles that come to mind would be machine learning, artificial intelligence experts, software engineers, and so on. But actually, there's a really wide variety of roles when you break it down in terms of sales, marketing, project management, design, that are all now tech-enabled and use advanced technological software to support them. But they're not quite the same as the roles that are building the technology. And I think just giving people an awareness and understanding of the breadth of roles there, I think is helpful, because then suddenly it's not a big unknown. It's not as scary. When you understand what's going on, you can understand what people mean by some of the jargon behind it. Suddenly things become far more accessible. And I think the other point we see is that there is sadly a confidence issue. So we see that age discrimination is still prevalent in the UK across all sectors and across all companies and industries. And actually, that can have a real knock on people's confidence. And we see that a fair bit at Restless. And I think it's just that having the confidence and being able to do the research and find the materials to help people do that can give them the confidence they need to actually push further and push into a career change.
So the message is, don't be put off by the seeming complexity at all, but give it a try.
Exactly. And I think necessity often breeds innovation. And I think the pandemic more than ever before has created that spur for people trying things out for the first time. And I think they've been remarkably kind of encouraged at how easy some of it is. You just need to look at rates of digital banking adoption in those in the 70s or 80s. And you can see that the very real health risk of going into a branch has forced people to consider mobile banking adoption. And that's not going back anytime soon when people find out how easy it is.
I think taking the first steps can be really challenging, actually. You know, I think we need to try and help people understand more about, as Stuart was saying, what opportunities exist. So, you know, Microsoft launched a Get On 2021 campaign last year to inspire even more people to explore into career in tech. And there is a whole host of resource on the Microsoft UK Digital Skills Hub, which allows people to learn a little bit more around what jobs are available, what skills are required, and how they can go about learning. And so we're definitely trying to encourage people to spend some time using those resources to really unlock the opportunity.
Yes, I looked on the Microsoft website and I noticed it was talking about a digital skills week, but it didn't actually say when this week is. I got the impression, reading between the lines, that it could be any time that you want it to be.
Well, we run these digital skills weeks normally on a quarterly basis. We ran one in November, and prior to that, we ran one in August. So we'll be continuing to run these. But there's also opportunity for people to gain access to free content at any time by visiting opportunity.linkedin.com, which gives people a list of the top 10 most in-demand jobs and also the skills required to do those jobs, with a whole set of learning paths and content to be able to follow to really see if they are able to kind of follow those learning paths to gain the skills required. So we have skills content available for people to use for free anytime on opportunity.linkedin.com.
And this is something that any individual can do. It doesn't have to be done through your company.
That's correct. Absolutely. It's a free set of resources for people to use to understand more about what jobs exist in tech and how they can go about building the skills accordingly.
That sounds very useful. Stuart and Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. I was talking to Simon Lambert, the Chief Learning Officer of Microsoft, and Stuart Lewis, an employment expert from Restless, about the factors which deter over 45s from getting involved with IT in the workplace. If you want to find out more, you can go to the following website, opportunity.linkedin.com. That's opportunity.linkedin.com. And you'll find plenty of information there about courses run by Microsoft and about job vacancies. And once again, I must apologise for the sound quality on that interview. Zoom isn't always 100% reliable, as you probably know. Well, for quite some time now, we've all been obsessed with COVID-19 and wondering whether we're likely to fall victim to it. And of course, that's a perfectly valid fear to have. But the presence of this pandemic doesn't mean that other diseases have gone away. Diseases such as lung cancer, for example. Recently, Public Health England launched a publicity campaign entitled Help Us Help You to remind us that lung cancer is still around and not to ignore the symptoms. The campaign is partly fronted by the media medic Dr. Hilary Jones. And recently, I hooked up with him via Zoom and asked him to tell me more.
It's important that we raise awareness about the possibility during this COVID-19 pandemic that people realise that a persistent cough lasting more than 3 weeks that isn't COVID-19 could be something more serious and potentially sinister, such as lung cancer. We know that there are something like 39,300 people diagnosed for the first time every year in England with lung cancer. And therefore, particularly for people over 60, if you've got a persistent cough lasting more than 3 weeks that isn't COVID-19, I would really encourage you to contact your GP surgery, talk about your symptoms, and be guided by your GP as to how to be investigated and referred if necessary to get it diagnosed.
Yes, people like people of my sort of age remember the campaigns way back about the connection between smoking and lung cancer, and so I think we rather tend to have it in our minds that only smokers are at risk, but that's not entirely true, is it?
No, that's right. Smoking, of course, is a major risk factor, as well as increasing age. However, there are many people who've never smoked and never even been exposed to passive smoke who still develop lung cancer. Cancer can sometimes be quite random, whether it's bowel cancer, breast cancer. There isn't always a genetic link. There isn't always an occupational link or a lifestyle link. And therefore, being aware of symptoms is paramount. And if you've got a persistent cough lasting more than 3 weeks that isn't COVID, if you've got increasing breathlessness, which is unexplained, extreme fatigue, loss of appetite or weight, if you're getting frequent chest infections for no explained reason, it's really important to talk to a GP right now about these symptoms. And remember that whilst COVID-19 has been lots of people's focus for the last year, other conditions are still there. They haven't gone away. And that the NHS is open for business and is happy to see you and actually would encourage you to come and see us, because that's why we've called this campaign Help Us to Help You.
I think that a lot of people, particularly older people, tend to be a bit reluctant to bother the GP during the COVID crisis.
That's absolutely true. And we know from a survey of more than 2,000 people that many people said that 31% of the ones who aren't aware of the importance of the symptoms said that they didn't want to be a burden, and 25% said that they weren't sure that it would be a safe place to visit at the moment, hospital or GP services. But what I would say is that, first of all, you're not a burden, not at all. If you've got something serious, it needs to be sorted out, and the NHS is open for business. We don't consider you a burden. We consider you helping us to help you. The second thing is that GP surgeries and hospitals have COVID secure areas where you're absolutely safe. And it's important that you remember that so that you don't put off going along and getting it sorted out. And please don't think that your symptoms might just go away on their own. A lot of people are in denial about that. And we're here to help you to sort, you know, the wheat from the chaff, if you like, to say whether it's something less sinister, something like silent acid reflux from the stomach, sinusitis, where you're swallowing some mucus, making you cough. It might be something as simple as that, probably is. But it's best not to avoid going to see somebody if you've got something serious, because early diagnosis means early treatment and a much better outcome in the future.
And how easy is it to treat if caught early?
Well, it's much easier. The outlook is so much better. And some people are cured. If it's confined to the lung, for example, could be that surgery to remove a lobe of the lung is all you need. But once it's extended, you know, between lobes of the lung, or extended further away from the lung itself into other parts of the body, much more difficult to treat and to control. So, as I say, early treatment's essential.
So, in fact, by going to your GP as soon as you can, you're actually saving the NHS work rather than making extra work.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, in the last year, despite the huge pressures and challenges that the NHS have had to face, we have maintained cancer services really well when you consider it. And some cancer services have run as usual. We've seen an increase in the number of cases of cancer that across the board that have been treated in between March and December of 2020. Lung cancer referrals have fallen off a little bit. They're still up to 73% of where they were a year before, but we need to get them back up to 100%. So we're seeing as many people as possible to get them treated as early as possible.
So, apart from going to the GP, where can people get more information about this?
Well, about the symptoms, there's a very good website, the NHS Cancer Symptoms website, very worthwhile looking at. But then we're really directing people to contact their GP. So if they know the symptoms and they've got those symptoms, then the GP surgery is the first port of call. They're open for business and they're happy to see you.
That's very encouraging. Dr. Hilary Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and take care. Have a good day.
I was talking to Dr. Hilary Jones about the prevalence of lung cancer and what can be done about it. Dr. Jones recommended a website that you can go to find out what the symptoms of lung cancer are. It's run by the NHS, and the address is nhs.uk/cancer-symptoms. That's nhs.uk/cancer-symptoms. And cancer symptoms is typed all as one word with no spaces. If you suspect that you might have the early stages of lung cancer, then the thing to do is to go and see your GP as soon as possible. You won't be imposing on them, and you'll be saving the NHS a lot of trouble in the long run. Well, an unfortunate but understandable consequence of the recent lockdowns has been that there's been a general increase in instances of domestic abuse. Since 1994, there's been a charitable organisation called RISE operating in Brighton and Hove, which provides practical help ranging from direct advice to refuge accommodation for those women whose lives are at risk, and of course its services are particularly needed at present. Much of the charity's funding has been in a grant from Brighton and Hove City Council, unless they were extremely distressed to hear recently that that funding is about to be withdrawn from them and redeployed elsewhere. To find out more, I spoke to Ali Cisse, and I began by asking her to tell me a bit more about what RISE is and what it does.
RISE is a charity that was set up 26 years ago, and it's run by women. It's Women's Aid accredited and Women's Aid affiliated. And really they're specialists in providing services and tailored services for women who are living with or recovering from domestic abuse. It's a very wide net these days. You know, it's anything from violence, coercive control, financial control, sexual violence, and the like. They support the women that contact them, their families, but RISE also do important amount of research as well. So the statistics they gather goes to Women's Aid. It's part of lobbying for government and collecting a broad picture of what life is like for women in this country and different areas in the country, like, you know, as well. So their work is very broad, and they are experts.
So it's been going since 1994, which is quite a long-standing organisation, really. It must have been one of the earliest in the field, I would imagine.
Yes, and they certainly built the refuge service here. And of course, they're really embedded in Brighton as part of the community. I think most people do know somebody that's had to use their services. And I think a lot of people have either raised money for them directly, have donated household objects, or been involved in other ways as well.
Now, would you say that the problem of domestic abuse has got worse over those 26 years?
I think that the problem with statements like that is these things are very hard to measure. So RISE can only measure the level of domestic abuse via the amount of people that reach out and get in contact with them. So we know that, for example, there's a real issue with elder abuse and women kind of over the age of 50 and 60 who don't get in touch with RISE. We also know that women with disabilities are less likely to get in touch but overrepresented. So it's quite complicated, because what we're talking about is reported or prosecuted or self-referred, which can only indicate so much of the real picture.
And I suppose as the organisation gets better known, more people will turn to it.
Well, I think that the thing with RISE is because they have a portal, I think every health professional, anybody involved in criminal justice, OASIS, the Women's Project, the police, they all know RISE and have a very intimate and strong working connection with them. And I think most women in the city would know of RISE and where to turn. It's just a question as to when, really, they would do that.
You mentioned the portal. Could you tell me what that is?
Well, it's really a hub where people can be referred to services. It's a catch-all, and then people get sieved out and pushed into the correct direction for the most tailored and appropriate support according to their needs.
And how do people make contact with the portal?
If you're in ladies' toilets, for example, there's posters up via the website, via referral through social services, via a volunteer phone line as well. So there's lots of ways of getting in touch.
So probably the main ways would be via the internet or via the telephone.
Yes, yes. Or often what will happen as well is women, when they find themselves in hospital or in custody or with the police, then those services will refer and pass the details on as well.
Now, I gather that RISE is having something of a crisis at the moment in terms of its funding. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, it's a real crisis, actually, because RISE offers an umbrella of services, and these services are generally funded by different pots of money procured from different places. Now, what's happened is that RISE have always had a contract from the council to run the refuge service at just over £1 million a year. Now, this contract has never been quite enough to cover the cost of the refuge, is my understanding. So RISE have always had to do a lot of additional fundraising to top the money up. Anyway, the contract is coming to an end, so it went out to procurement. And unfortunately, the procurement process was rather flawed. It went to a joint procurement, which meant that the social value that should have been part of the evaluating process wasn't in fact included. So RISE found out very recently that they no longer have the contract to run that service, which leaves a huge hole in their funds, and that I understand they're going to be without an office very soon. So it's not great news for RISE.
So has the contract gone to an organisation who were able to provide the service more cheaply?
Essentially, yes. The social value is added to procurement to ensure that it doesn't become just about the bottom line. So it's not a continual lower and underbidding and underbidding and underbidding. That's the facility that's put in to protect against that, because, of course, refuge services are essential and not cheap. So it's gone to a national housing association called Stonewater UK, who are not a particularly specialist organisation. They're certainly not Women's Aid accredited. And there's various issues with them, the service users who I kind of represent are not particularly happy about. But yes, essentially they've got it because they've undercut RISE. And it's not just that the refuge will not be of the same standard, but also the fact that it's now going to a whole different organisation. That represents a fragmentation of all of the services that are much better provided, really, by one main organisation.
And is there anything that can be done to reverse this decision, do you think?
Well, Richard, I'm not a lawyer, but I have seen, there was a very similar case in Bristol with a specialist refuge that lost some of their services to a national company that had essentially underbid them. And that decision was changed. It went to a high court and the judge evaluated who would provide the best service for the city. And the contract was then given back to the original local providers that were a charity. So the council seemed very keen to say that the contracts are signed and nothing can be done. My view is, as a service user, is what's most important is that we procure the correct service to cover and reflect the real needs of our city. And it's not really okay for those women living with and surviving and escaping domestic abuse to have to take the burden of a really poor outcome of their procurement. So I think that there is a lot of hope for Stonewater to move out of the contract. And I would hope that they would do that, because I think once they realise the impact that they're going to have on Rise as a much loved local charity and experts in the field, I'm sure they would probably want to do the right thing.
And there is a campaign running to keep the service in, with Rise in Brighton, isn't there?
Yes. So, I mean, that's really who I'm speaking for today. So I'm a service user of Rise, and we're really just elevating a very silenced voice within the community, which is women living with abuse who often can't speak out about it. So we're kind of providing a hub for those voices and expressing how we feel about it, because we weren't asked in the procurement process.
So if people want to support the campaign, what can they do about it?
Well, we have Nicola's wonderful petition, which I think now is over 26,000 signatures. But what we have is a website, which is a really great landing point. So if you go to change.org and look for the Rise Up petition in Brighton, there's links to the website there. There's template emails to write to your councillors, your MPs. You can add your hand to the campaign. So people are taking a photograph of their hand with Rise Up on. And you can read and keep up with all of the media coverage on that website.
Now, there was a council meeting just recently, wasn't there? Do you know if there was anything said about this at that particular meeting?
Well, there was, because actually something that's been really wonderful is amongst the councillors, there's been a universal understanding and appreciation that the procurement somehow has gone very wrong and this is a very bad outcome for the city. So in a sense, we're very lucky because we have a lot of support for Rise and we have a lot of understanding of the impact that this decision has on Rise. So at the annual council meeting, the Greens did suggest an amendment to make some additional funds available for Rise, which I'm sure Rise are very grateful for. But to be clear, Rise did lose a contract which is worth £5 million over 7 years. And what they've got in crumbs from the council budget meeting is a 95k one-off payment and 50k for, I think, 2 or 3 years afterwards, which, although sounds like a lot of money, in terms of providing a specialist service, is really just crumbs from the table. So I'm sure Rise really do appreciate that money, but that doesn't resolve the issue that we have with the contracts, really. Women simply will not refer themselves to a service if they don't have the trust in it. And of course, many service users have been accessing Rise not just for a year, not for 2 years, some of them for 10 years. You know, they've seen babies grow into adults. I mean, the nature of domestic abuse really is that once you've built a relationship with them, it's very hard to then have to rebuild a relationship with another organization. If you want to get in touch with the campaign, we have a WordPress website, which is Brighton Rise Up. That's all one word, brightonriseup.wordpress.com. And you can find everything there, the petition, how to donate to Rise, any blogs you want to add. You can read other people's testimonies, add your hands to our wall of Rise Up hands, and obviously get the templates to write to your MPs and to write to your councillors would be wonderful. because they are listening, and we need to show them what women of Brighton want, really.
Yes, they may not have, when they took the decision, they may not have really thought in detail about the consequences.
No, I think not. And I think that this is the thing. The procurement is really designed to stop this kind of thing happening, because everybody understands that the cheapest bidder is not necessarily the best outcome, because social value, the fact that Rise know the characters of all of the judges, the fact that they've got a relationship with the police, they know head teachers, they know good solicitors, all of those things that can't be quantified and held in a database, you know, is the local knowledge that Rise really have that is what really helps them in their hour of need. So, yes, I think that it is really important to recognise. The council itself recognises that the procurement went wrong. The council isn't really defending what's happened here. They're saying that something's gone wrong and they might not be able to change it, but they're certainly not defending it. And I think there is a universal concern, really, for what's happened, and that we must make sure that this kind of thing can't happen again.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much for telling me all about that, and more power to your elbow, as they say.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ali. I've been talking to Ali Cisse about Rise and about the campaign that's been launched to try and restore their funding under the name Rise Up. If you want to find out more about the campaign, there's a website you can go to, which is brightonriseup.wordpress.com. That's Brighton Rise Up, typed all as one word with no spaces, .wordpress.com. If you want to make use of Rise's services, their helpline is on Brighton 622828. That's 01273 622828. They also have a website, which is www.riseuk.org.uk. That's www.riseuk, typed all as one word, .org.uk. And the telephone number for their portal is 0300 323 9985. That's 0300 323 9985. Well, I was talking earlier about some of the problems of the recent lockdowns, and of course different people have adopted different strategies in order to get through them. In my case, I found a great help has been radio and television. And one of the television programmes that I've particularly enjoyed, which is still running, is a programme called The Architecture the Railways Built, which is on the Yesterday Channel. It's a series that's been running since last May. And back then, just before it began, Chris English spoke to the presenter, Tim Dunn, and asked him what sort of architecture we're talking about.
Oh, we're looking at all sorts. We're looking at about 40 different buildings, ranging from, you know, big stations like King's Cross and St Pancras. We're down to sort of little countryside wayside stations and signal boxes too, railway hotels, viaducts, tunnels. it's the full range of engineering and buildings that have either been built by or because of the railways.
Where did all this start?
Well, as in the railways start building architecture, I suppose railways started actually in the Georgian times, before the Victorians kind of era started. And we saw classical railway buildings and sort of early stuff that looked almost like some country houses for stations. And then as railways sort of proliferated across the UK and Europe, you see this maturity in design of different types of buildings, and a massive variety of styles as different localities and competing companies chose different styles for their different railway lines. So you see all sorts of different influences of time, location, architect, giving this incredible variety of stuff that you see today that still surrounds our railway network.
And, of course, we've got an example here in Brighton with the Mercator train shed at Brighton Station.
Oh, an absolute favourite of mine. I mean, we didn't get to visit on this series, unfortunately, but Macarthur's architecture is just wonderful. You know, and he's thought to have influenced a lot of stations up and down the south coast, and indeed the viaducts that connected up to London. But yeah, I mean, I love Brighton Station. I mean, there's little quirks to it that I really enjoy. I mean, again, this programme sort of looks at some of the grand stuff like that, sort of looks down on the ground. So, I mean, if you go into Brighton Station, you can still see one of the platforms is still made of wood. If you notice this, if you go across to one side of it, on the eastern side, is still a wooden platform from many years ago. So history is right underneath our feet.
Some of the architecture we've lost.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we celebrate, of course, the great stuff, but there are some that have gone. Some people bemoan the fact we lost the Euston Station that was knocked down to build the 1960s Euston Station. There are some interesting bits to it, but it had to go because it was a big sort of mishmash. But things like, you know, the great Euston Hall, designed by Philip Hardwick, was a great structure. And of course, the big famous Doric arch outside is one that we had lost and really could have been saved. But, you know, a lot of our disused railway lines around the UK, weirdly, still exist with their structures, and they've been turned into homes and so on. But you're right, some of the stuff that we have lost is truly very sad. And some of our larger railway stations in cities have been changed. But of course, railways are not there to be museum pieces. They are there as vital infrastructure. You know, railways are there to deliver something. And we're just lucky that so much of the past has survived.
Absolutely. And talking of the past, I mean, preserved railways, are there any examples on preserved railways?
Oh, yeah. We go off to the Ffestiniog Railway in northwest Wales, which is one of my favourite railway lines in the world. I mean, I've been to it hundreds of times. And we go and look at how they've built this deviation to get round a lake that swallowed up the north part of their line. And the volunteers built an embankment and a tunnel and a bridge to get across this new landscape to go around the edge of this lake. And then we go to places like Dartmouth, where there's a railway station at Dartmouth, which has never seen a train because it's built on the other side of the river to the main railway station. So it's a railway station kind of set back away from the railway itself. But yeah, there are quite a few other ones we go to just around the UK because, again, so many wonderful people have spent time and joy restoring these things, either for a new function or back to its original function of actually serving trains. There's a great one at Wolferton Royal Station out in Norfolk, where a couple of people over the years have restored the former Royal Station for the Sandringham Estate back to its original royal status. It has these incredible waiting rooms that is now this man's wonderful home. They even turned the signal box into a kind of like a granny flat and a summer house. It's remarkable to see.
Look forward to seeing it. And remind us, Tim, when is it on and where?
Well, it's on the Yesterday channel, which is a free-to-view channel on satellite. So Yesterday, it's on every Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock. It's also on UK TV Play for catch-up.
Lovely. Tim, thank you very much for joining us, and more power to your elbow.
Thank you so much. A pleasure talking to you.
Chris English was talking to Tim Dunn, who presents the architecture of the railways built on the Yesterday channel every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. You can get the Yesterday channel on Freeview channel 26, Freesat channel 159, and online at yesterday.uktv.co.uk. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English, and I'll be back with you in a month. Until then, it only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme, and to wish you all the very best. Goodbye. Take care.